specific goal of addressing local priorities like risk factors or vulnerabilities related to crime and complex social issues. This approach really recognizes that the feeling of community safety and well-being goes beyond the incidence of crime. In other words, there are factors that influence one's perception of whether a community is safe, regardless of whether a crime has occurred. This could be things like stigma, blighted buildings, even a poverty of opportunities in a community. Connected to this is that for every risk, there is a community strength, asset, and protective value, and that these should be our starting points. So as important as it is to identify those risk factors and vulnerabilities, we must also ensure that we identify and build upon the strengths and assets that exist in our communities. Currently, there are absolutely phenomenal partnerships that cut across multiple sectors in our region, and leveraging these partnerships and communities is a critical success factor. We should not be building from the ground up, especially when we have such amazing projects available to us. Community members are facing challenges to their safety, their health, their well-being that are truly complex and systemic. When we consider the challenges that our residents may be facing, they likely intersect with other social challenges. And from a resource standpoint, they likely cut across sectors and funding portfolios. So in that mind, keeping that in mind, all community members in all sectors have a role to play. And as such, they should, as many people as possible should be consulted. And finally, but most importantly, that these strategies must be culturally responsive. This must be a process that gives consideration to social and historical context and power imbalances. As such, we must start with the intent of having meaningful dialogue with individuals and groups from diverse backgrounds. I know I went through quite a bit, but when you consider those pieces, the vision for community safety and well-being that our leadership table defined as it really kind of keys into those points. And the definition that our leadership table kind of used was one that's a community where everyone feels safe, has a sense of belonging, equitable access to services and opportunities, and can have their needs met across Windsor and Essex County. And so you'll notice that included in those in that definition are those elements of the CSWB framework. But speaking of that, I'll jump in a bit more into the CSWB framework itself. As it does, it identify four areas of intervention. And this is really important because we can intervene through social development, that layer at the top, prevention, risk intervention, and incident response. But let's start with incident response. This is commonly what we think of safety interventions. We primarily will focus on the center of that bullseye at the incident itself. We tend to approach it from a policing, fire, or emergency services perspective. But as I indicated beforehand, research is showing that more and more often, police and emergency services are responding to situations related to well-being that are symptoms of larger issues, whether it be a mental health crisis, substance use challenge, or housing insecurity. And despite how well-trained our first responders are across the region, because they are, these are issues that they can't solve alone. So let's move up a layer to risk intervention. This layer focuses on reducing harm before it becomes a critical or non-critical incident. These situations are what are called acutely elevated risk situations, or situations where if action does not occur, does not happen, it will likely lead to harm to oneself or to others. And this is the type of work that is being done by groups like Situation Tables across the province and within Windsor Essex, and involves usually partnerships between city departments, healthcare, public safety, and community partners. The next layer above that is prevention. And prevention is really about proactively identifying and addressing local risks before they escalate. And also, prevention necessitates the involvement of all people regardless of their expertise. To think of it in a different way, people in neighborhoods or communities will be the first to notice when a change, positive or negative, has occurred in their community or in their area. And that's because they're really in tune with their daily environments and are therefore a great resource to finding those protective factors and assets to meet that change. Finally, when we go to the very top again, to the green layer, social development, this is usually involving longer term investments or strategies to improve what are called the social determinants of health and well-being, or the underlying conditions that shape daily life. And these are, for example, access to income, education, job security, quality housing, just to name a few. Work in this layer involves us looking beyond the incident at the social causes and understanding that those causes need integrated and collective responses. To pull these concepts together, if instead of starting at the incident as the primary area of intervention, we started at the social development layer. Then we can build on protective factors and strengths. We can emphasize prevention and risk mitigation strategies through the use of data and evidence-based practice, and ultimately work to reduce our incident response rate by intervening before challenges become crises. So for your reference, I've included my talking points for each of the areas on slides 9 to 12, but because I've discussed each section, I will continue on to slide 13. So, to conclude this section, overall, these plans recognize that there are existing strengths and leadership within our community, and that there are across multiple sectors as well that can be leveraged and engaged to proactively address local priorities related to crime and complex social issues. This is not about reinventing the wheel, and by promoting upstream activities and focusing on social development, prevention, and risk intervention, we're really working to stop challenges from turning into crises or incidents. Again, incident response is, of course, a vital part of the puzzle, but once again, the goal of these plans is to be proactive. Ultimately, the nature of this approach, its inclusion of diverse voices to the identification of priority risks and strengths, means that these plans should be seen as living documents that can be built upon over time. And considering these points, our plan, while developed regionally, will include appendices for each municipality. And the intent here is to ensure that local priorities in each municipality are identified. Now that we have a bit of a better background on the CSWD planning process, let's jump into the second takeaway, which is current project updates. As you may recall in our last council report to the city and county council, we provided updates in relation to the project pause due to COVID-19. In brief, some highlights of that report include that staff were redeployed between the months of March and June, that letters to AMO and OMSA were written advocating for an extension to January 1st, 2022, and that all project team meetings were put on a pause. And really all of these pieces were because if you think of our own departments, our own municipalities, we were all being taxed by increased workloads and responsibilities, and so too were our community partners. And so the reason why we had those project team meetings on a pause was because we knew we needed to ensure that they were available and able to, and actually have the capacity to re-engage in the process. And that took a little bit of time. So since the July council report, there were a few updates as well. So consulting firm Strategy Corp was successfully awarded the contract through an RFP process. And one thing that is positive, I believe that we had recently had a meeting with Strategy Corp prior to this. They've been a great team to work with. We've also been able to re-engage project teams, and we have re-engaged our AMO and OMSA representatives and working groups. A particular point that's important to discuss here is the OMSA re-engagement. Because through the OMSA CSWD working group, we're able to connect with other municipalities in the province who are completing these plans as well. And so through discussions with them on their status on the project and their expected timelines, a few things became very clear. Number one, we are actually in a very strong position as we did not go to public consultation as originally was planned in April and May. So these early consultations we would have been able to assess the potential impact of the pandemic on individual and community priorities. So this offers us an opportunity to ask those questions during our consultation. Number two, our requested extension was actually right in line with other municipalities. Consensus was established amongst the municipalities that a deadline of December 31st, 2021 would be most appropriate for most municipalities. Additionally, AMO and OMSA representatives would be advocating for that December 31st, 2021 deadline. And lastly, we are on par with the majority of municipalities as it pertains to project. In regards to our current status, two other deliverables that I'd like to introduce are our risk factor data categories and our asset mapping. With the help of our data team, comprised of data analysts and stewards from the leadership table member organizations, we were really able to synthesize and identify risk and protective factor categories into the seven categories that you see before you. From there, our consultants to validate and finalize the indicators for each category. So clearly, since neither the consultants or I have the expertise in each one of those sectors, it was really important for us to be able to connect with that data team. And so we are very fortunate to have that amount of talent on this project. Both quantitative and qualitative data was collected from a regional and municipal level of analysis as well. And so we were able to ask those questions of the data team. So why is this all important? It's important because the information will form the basis, or has formed the basis of our current state analysis, and will also inform the development of our online survey, and ultimately will support the leadership table and the enhanced sector network, which I'll discuss in a few moments, in identifying and contextualizing some of these local issues. The second key deliverable is asset mapping. And since the project really focuses on leveraging existing strengths and strategies, asset mapping is vitally important. In our context, an existing body inventory, for example, has helped shape the development of the leadership table and the enhanced sector network. The strategy inventory has helped us in the development of our current state analysis report, and our asset map will actually be helping us in ensuring that the existing community strengths and assets across the region are considered when developing our recommendations. The RCSWB asset map is truly a highlight for me. I wish I could show you the interactive approach. Right now, you're not getting the full version of it, but this was something that was completed in partnership with the City of Windsor's Geomatics Department, and also that assets were kind of compiled in consultation with 211 and the County of Essex Geomatics Department, which all three have amazing teams. And I have to say, actually, as of Friday afternoon, that number is updated, as we now have over 1,240 assets, and this was done with the support of our leadership table. Our intent is to make this interactive map, asset map, available in public once we have it fully finalized. But to give you a bit of a sneak peek, in terms of how the asset map works out for Amherstburg specifically, there are currently 50 assets that were identified in Amherstburg across each of those sectors here, each of these categories, these data categories. And you'll see on the right-hand side, there's a legend of some of the subcategories that are searchable. And I must say, because this was completed on October 14th, this legend has actually been expanded to include a few more different subcategories, including Francophone community organizations, Francophone health services, to name a few, and actually places of worship as well, to name a few, because all of these are important assets in our community. So again, this is our intent to make this publicly available. For the third and final takeaway, we'll dive a bit deeper into our project methodologies. Clearly, COVID-19 has made an impact on normal methods of public engagement. And in consideration of the pandemic and the pandemic restrictions, we have opted to move towards a fully online engagement process and to try and mediate barriers to participation by really ensuring that we can include dial-in options as well as CSWB toolkits or paper copies of the survey. Our engagement approach has five pillars. The first is one that we're doing today, which is the municipal council presentation. We really wanted to ensure that all elected officials within the region were familiar and informed of the CSWB planning efforts. The second is the enhanced sector network, which I'll discuss shortly. And the third and fourth are more of the public consultation methods, third being online and print surveys, and fourth being virtual town halls. We are having one session per municipality and two sessions for the City of Louisville at that virtual town hall approach. And finally, really as it relates to you all, there will be virtual focus groups with CAOs and elected officials for each municipality. You'll notice that the timing of these focus groups occur after the public consultation process. And that's really because we wanted to ensure that you were able to review the latest information prior to providing input. And so that would be the reason why we have that, in time. Going on to the enhanced sector network, is the purpose of this approach is to really ensure that diverse voices from historically underrepresented communities are heard, and their priorities are really woven throughout the planning process. And we feel that this is a way to best inform that CSWB process and the leadership table by ensuring that we're contextualizing the community data that we have from multiple population lenses. So again, pairing that quantitative data with the qualitative data. For clarity, ESN will consist of 8 network groups as listed, and each group will be comprised of representatives from existing committees and community organizations. We will be asking group members to participate in 2 meetings over the course of the project, and those meetings will involve qualitative activities as well as a prioritization process, again, based on the results of the public consultation. To recap in kind of a pictorial form, this is our overall engagement approach. If we start with the lower half of the image, you'll notice that there are general and stratified community engagement approaches. The general approach is that public consultation, the online surveys, the virtual town halls. And in the green, the stratified approach is the ESNs and speaking to the elected officials. And the reason why we have these different kind of sections, especially with respect to the enhanced sector network being under stratified, is because there are sometimes what's called self-selection bias. So when you're opening up to public consultations, there may be challenges for certain population groups to hear the message, to know that there are virtual town halls that are being completed, or to know that there is an online survey. And so by ensuring that we're providing some of that information through the enhanced sector networks, we try to maximize the number of people that we can connect to. In this regard as well, we know that we would love to have everyone at the table for those enhanced sector network groups under those categories, but realistically that wouldn't be possible. And so one way that we're trying to bypass that that issue is to ensure that we have what's called a notification list. So we are requesting from all municipalities to be providing some list of all community organizations that they feel should be included on that on the notification list, so that they're aware of the online surveys as well as when the virtual town halls will be underway. So finally, when we're looking at the overall project timeline, we do have a time frame of 16 months. And again, that that time frame was what we factored in was that presumed extended deadline of December 31st, 2021. We've also factored in the impacts of both COVID-19 and the need for greater diversity and inclusion in the planning process. So ultimately, we do expect to begin our consultation period in February 2021, and be submitting this report to city and county councils between the months of September and November in 2021 as well. So thank you very much for your time. I know it is at a premium today, especially. So again, thank you, I appreciate that. If you have any questions, Chief Mizuno, Mr. Providenti, and I are available for questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions or comments? Okay, I think it was very self-explanatory, and thank you for the presentation and the update, and especially thank you for your patience and the delay in the meeting. And that is it, the motion to receive. Councillor Simone, Councillor MacArthur, all those in favor, carried. And motion to adjourn, Councillor Courtney and Councillor Reno, all those in favor, carried. Thank you.